Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Andrew Soffin will be telling us about IAEDP. So, can you tell me a little bit about IAEDP?
Yes. So, the International Association for Eating Disorder Professionals, it's a professional association for people who specialize in eating disorder work. So, for the most part, that would be therapists and nutritionists, I would say would be the bulk. Obviously, that ranges anywhere from psychiatrists to social workers to psychotherapists to psychologists, and obviously nutritionists and dietitians, and a lot of people also work in private practice, and those who work in academia or the hospitals and medical care.
So, what are some of the most common impacts of an eating disorder?
So, first and foremost, eating disorders, they can have an enormous impact on one's health. So obviously with somebody who's anorexic, if they get into medical complications, they could be hospitalized, it'll affect their cognitive functioning. Bulimics, sometimes it could even lead to a heart attack, even in somebody who's quite young. So the biggest danger is medical. And obviously it also impacts their personal lives, so their social lives, work, it can impact their day-to-day ability to function.
In your work, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions about eating disorders?
Oh, there's so many. One of the most common ones is obviously portrayed more in the media and sort of the Hollywood versions. Most of the time, eating disorders are portrayed as the anorexic, so somebody who is malnourished, somebody who is far below a healthy body weight. And very often, yes, that's part of what eating disorders are, severe anorexia nervosa, but it's also, eating disorders can occur in people who will look quite, quote-unquote, normal. So, and actually, is sometimes the bulimics is the most dangerous, because when they binge and purge, it can throw the whole body's system out of whack and their electrolytes, and to the point of where they can have a heart attack and they're only 20. So, it's eating disorders are not just somebody who's severely anorexic. I think that's one of the biggest myths.
So, when you mention about bulimics, binging and purging, isn't there a risk of ultimately being unable to intake food if vomiting is induced that much?
Everything all depends when you catch the eating disorder, and also how many times are they binging and purging. Yes, there can be risks to the esophagus, and there can also be great risk to their teeth. In other words, the acids from when they purge can really degrade the teeth to the point of, you know, it's enormous dental work. But I would say the most dangerous part is when the electrolytes get thrown off and we're looking at possibilities of heart attacks being something that is a very, very real scare. And the throat obviously can be it's just dangerous to be obviously doing this over and over and over again. They usually can return to eating quite normally and everything when it is addressed, obviously when they get treatment.
So what are some of the most common treatment options available for someone with an eating disorder?
So obviously that always depends on where you live. So in Canada, usually the first step would be it's usually the primary care physician or somebody under 18, the pediatrician. That's usually the first place that it is caught, maybe on an annual visit when the doctor might notice that, you know, well, with anorexics, they'll notice something off with the BMI, they'll notice that they are malnourished. And a lot of times they will interview, you know, at sort of saying, are you anything going on around your eating habits? Sometimes with the dentist, but the dentist will notice that the acid has eaten away at the back of the teeth. So that's usually the first place, or sometimes school counselors, or sometimes, you know, they will bring it to their family or friends. And then usually the next step is finding a therapist. So it's usually, eating disorders is very much a team-based approach. They have to have a doctor to make sure their blood work is okay, make sure that they are not medically compromised or in danger. So as long as they're medically okay, then you can do it on an outpatient basis. So they'll have a therapist who specializes in eating disorders. And very often they'll also have a nutritionist who specializes in eating disorders. And it's very important that this whole team is able to communicate amongst one another. And very often, if you have somebody, usually under 18, one of the best forms of treatment is called family-based treatment, FBT, where the parents are involved. And so there's a whole treatment protocol of how to help the parents work with their child around the eating disorder. Obviously, if it gets worse, then we're talking hospitalization and about, you know, restoring weight if it's an anorexic or getting treatment in a higher level setting.
So, in your time with the association, have there been any success moments that stand out for you?
Well, with the association, I'm chapter chair for Canada, so I'm really sort of advocating for, you know, helping other Canadians that work in the mental health landscape or nutrition landscape, you know, to get involved with IDEP, because I really believe IDEP is very good at providing training for many people who, you know, otherwise would not be able to access that specialized training. Because if you think about it, in Canada, we don't have a lot of specialized training in our public university system around eating disorders. So I think one of the big successes is really encouraging more people to get involved in IDEP and helping people catch eating disorders before they end up in the hospital. I think that's the best thing about IDEP is it gives people that at least a basic training and understanding, wait a minute, this is an eating disorder, let's address it now. Let's get a hold of it now. Because the one thing we know with eating disorders, the earlier you catch it, usually the greater the prognosis for a successful outcome. Whereas the longer it sort of, the eating disorder gets embedded, the harder it is to, as it were, dislodge it.
So where can people go about finding out more information about how to get involved with IADEP?
Probably the best place to go is to the website, IADEP.com, and anybody who works in the eating disorder field can become a member and get involved in different aspects of the association. And anybody who's living in Canada and wants to get involved, they can even reach out to me directly, and I'd be happy to kind of get them involved, especially in the Canada chapter of IDEP, because I think the more Canadians we have in IDEP, the more we can really advocate for addressing eating disorders within the Canadian context, which we all know is quite different than the American context, or the UK, or other places in the world.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely. It was great meeting you, too.
Thanks.
In this segment of our show, Stephanie Salville will be telling us about PRRF.
So, can you tell me a bit about PRRF?
Sure. The Pediatric Retinal Research Foundation, PRRF, has been around for about 30 years, and it is an organization, the only one of its kind, that's dedicated to pediatric retinal research, as the name suggests. But we focus on a rare set of diseases that are affected with the retina in children, and it causes them to either have partial vision loss or become completely blind. And so our foundation's focus is to fund the research in hopes of treatments and cures for the children affected by the diseases. And that's especially important because rare diseases usually don't get funding from some of the large national and pharmaceutical companies because there's such a small population that's typically affected. The second part of what we do is our community programming. So it's not just research, we have some community programming as well.
So I'm curious, when you say these are rare conditions, about offhand, would you say, how many people are affected by these conditions?
So what's considered rare is anything that is diagnosed with less than 15,000 people. And so some of ours are very small and some of ours are larger in that rare category. So it's always going to be less than 15,000 people. And we actually have a lot of widespread cases that we work with and people we talk to throughout the world. So we're not specifically just talking about the United States. Our reach goes globally with folks that are affected.
So the supports you alluded to, can you tell me about some of the work you do with the community that's affected?
Yeah, so obviously we want to give hope for their future, which is the research component, but we also want to help people who are struggling today with different challenges related to their disease. So we offer a ton of educational programming that's free. So we have a webinar that we do Ask the Doc, which is a Q&A type format. We have a virtual conference that we host for free. And all of our educational programming is free for anyone to join throughout the world. And they have access to doctors that are experts in this industry. And they can ask them very specific questions about any of the diseases. And then we also love opportunities to connect families with one another. So if you've already been through this with your child, and perhaps if your child's not a toddler anymore, maybe they're in elementary school, we can connect a new parent to somebody who's been through it, and they can talk one-on-one to just get support and questions answered from a real-life experience perspective.
So in that sense, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions about these conditions?
Nothing immediately comes to mind in terms of myths or misconceptions. I think what is more common is just a lack of understanding of how the different diseases work, because they service seven different diseases, and they're all they have their own characteristics, they have their own causes and genetic findings, and they all have their own nuances associated. So a lot of times we're not debunking myths, we're just clarifying different elements of those diseases. And so people are usually just reaching for information that's not readily accessible when you do a Google search on a disease. Whereas if you get something much more popular or more well-known disease, you're going to find just a plethora of resources. That's not the case as much with some of these diseases.
So in your time with the foundation, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, I am so privileged and excited to be part of the foundation right now. They have been working on a treatment for one of the diseases called BPR. And they are currently going into clinical trials this year to offer a treatment to fever patients. This has been about 20 years in the making, from research beginning from, you know, the bench in the lab and collecting samples and doing all of the different efforts to actually getting it to commercialization, hopefully within the next 5 years or so. And so that is a huge milestone that I hope to be a part of and to be able to celebrate, to actually bring something to the families on the market and say, we finally have a treatment option for you. So that is the largest milestone that we're working on right now. And then we also hope to expand that into other diseases to get the ball rolling as our foundation grows and do other disease topics in the research lab as well.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward in the research and the advocacy, what would you say?
So, one, there's not a lot of resources for rare diseases, and that always, you know, is something that breaks my heart a little bit, that if something doesn't happen widespread, that it perhaps doesn't get a much attention. So these families are still suffering just as much as anybody else, and they deserve their opportunity at hope as well. But what we know about research is oftentimes it has a much larger spreading effect on other diseases that it was unintended for. So some of the research that we're doing now, we know there will be benefits for diabetic retinopathy. You know, things that people are going through who have diabetes, and other diseases have already been identified as potential benefits to this research. So even if supporting a rare disease perhaps isn't your passion, we also encourage folks to get involved and really help us push the mission forward, because we know it's going to help a bigger population as a subset of our effort and what we're trying to do.
So
you never know if that thing that's going to help your family, you know?
So what are the next steps for the foundation?
Yeah, so we're growing rapidly. We're really, really excited. We're getting ready to launch a podcast for the first time. The aim will be at helping folks who are facing different challenges in their day-to-day and bringing on guest speakers. So that's coming up next. We are working on our second annual conference that will be offered in early January 2023. And then we also have our fundraising walk that we're getting ready to launch as well. And so that's something we do locally here in the Metro Detroit area, physically. And then we also have virtual components all over the country. And so we're really excited to just rally, get people involved in the organization. We need volunteers at every level, and helping us really path that way into our future as we keep growing as an organization.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Think you've heard it all? Think again. Indian beatmaster Ritesh Das brings you the latest sound exploration with Japanese taiko, Macedonian folk, and Canadian rock icon Biff Naked. You've got to hear it to believe it. Juno-nominated Toronto Tabla Ensemble's new album, For the Love of Tabla, is out now.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Stephanie Salville told us a little bit about PRRF, and Andrew Soffin told us a little bit about IAEDP.
In this segment of our show, our friend Stephanie Craig will be sharing her latest insights concerning Turner syndrome. So, have there been any developments with the Turner Society that you want to share?
Sure. Yes. So, obviously, the pandemic has been a very impactful thing for the Turner Syndrome Society, but we've been trying to focus a lot on online initiatives. So last summer we did an online conference over a weekend where we had different guest speakers come in and speak about different topics like some reopening anxiety that could occur in people as the world starts opening up after the pandemic. We talked about various health issues that can be associated with Turner syndrome, and also had some social time where different generations of individuals with Turner syndrome could get together and chat about common experiences and get to know each other and build up their social networks. So it was a really big success, and we had a lot of our members were able to attend it, which is one of the perks to being able to do online things, because not as many people are able to attend the fees to attend in-person conferences and all the travel expenses. Go ahead.
I was just wondering, do you plan on keeping sort of a hybrid model for future events in terms of offering in-person to those who can be there and still with the online option?
That is definitely something that we've been considering moving forward. We are still continuing to plan to have monthly online social events for our membership, which will alternate between more formal educational topics where we'll have guest speakers, as well as more informal, just social times where we may just get together and chat or do online trivia or different online games. And then we are looking at doing an online option for when we are able to do our conferences in person again, and have people able to attend online sessions of the conference for reduced ticket fees.
So, when you mention educational topics, do you ever do anything on myths or misperceptions concerning Turner syndrome?
That is something that we have addressed in some of our topics. We haven't specifically had an educational topic surrounding that area, but in different topics, especially when it comes related to health topics, that is something that we really try to do. Is there can be so much misperception or fear surrounding different health topics, such as hearing loss, heart issues. So we really do just try to reduce some of the stigma around and misperceptions around those areas and provide our members with information and education and really kind of help them be able to make the most educated, well-informed decisions that they can.
So, how's the society going about reaching out to the Turner's community to let them know that supports are available?
We've been trying to do that through our social media networks, through Instagram, through Facebook, as well as sending out quarterly newsletters to our membership, which have information about upcoming social events, resources, and our emails and phone line are always open to contact if they have any questions or want to be connected with any resources.
So, in recent memory, have there been any successes for the society that have stood out for you?
I would say our conferences have definitely been some of our successes. The ability to get so many of our membership together to be able to meet and socialize with each other. We've had so many wonderful guest speakers come and share their expertise. And that
we've been able to find a way to continue that in more of an online format through the pandemic, as well as try to branch out into some more creative online social initiatives, I feel has definitely been a success of the society.
So, do you have any advice to the families out there who might be dealing with a new Turner's diagnosis?
I would say that, as with anything, you know, a new diagnosis can definitely be very scary, but I would say to please reach out and find supports, contact the Turner Syndrome Society of Canada, contact support groups on Facebook. There are so many very valuable support groups for Turner Syndrome, for other disabilities, on Facebook and other social media platforms. And I would also say that a lot of times, especially if you're hearing information from medical professionals right after the diagnosis, or you're Googling things, a lot of times you can get the worst case scenario or more extreme experiences. And there really is such a wide range of experiences and associated diagnoses and impact when it comes to Turner syndrome, that I want to let people know that the worst case scenario is usually not the most likely scenario, and that there are so many happy, successful girls and young women and older women and individuals living with Turner syndrome.
So, what are the next steps forward in your own initiatives?
Well, I'm currently the past president of the board of directors of the Turner Syndrome Society of Canada, so I hope to keep working with them to keep our society going and helping our membership as much as we can. And I am also in the process of finishing up my studies in the PhD program in applied social psychology at the University of Windsor. So I'm doing my dissertation research looking at media representations of disability, and I'm finishing up conducting my focus groups for that research. I'm looking for individuals over the age of 18 who have mobility impairments requiring the use of a wheelchair. So I'm hoping to finish up my data collection on that soon and then start analyzing my results and use the information that I get from my research to help provide recommendations and suggestions to individuals in the media and entertainment industries that come from the disability community.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Oh, of course. Thank you so much for having me. I always enjoy speaking with you, Cameron.
It's my pleasure.
My friends, I find it tragic there are still so many myths and stereotypes concerning eating disorders. It's not something a person willfully gets into. Fact is, it affects both mental health and physical health. Such people affected need just as much compassion, support, and uplifting as anyone else in society. If we stand with them, we can help them as they go through whatever it is that has led them there. And hopefully, we can lead them to a better place in both body, mind, and spirit. But the fact is, we can't just say, oh, I have compassion for one type of disability because I can see it, quantify it, and process it. There are things going on in the mind that we'll never understand, we'll never be able to see. But in no way does that change the fact there is a living, breathing, intelligent, capable person being affected. Keeping an open mind is sometimes all it takes to build the first plank of that bridge of understanding. Being willing to listen to someone. They say, this is affecting me and it is beyond my control. Have a little faith. Trust in that. And try to be a voice of support in their life. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me
You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.